The hope of the letter is the opening. Magnolia buds unfurling. Something dead now lives, the letter opening like the death that was and will again be between the pages, the simple feel of them, and on them something written about the life that was no more present than you were, until the opening of the letter, hope of which speaks like good news from buds, magnolia unfurling to face what was and what will be between the brief span, time it takes to write a letter, to open a letter and all the words that fit on the simple feel of pages made of the feeling of the letter that blooms the day before its death, blooms after the brief span, death the bud, death the stem, the green, green stem with its livid script unfurling your name in the matter of one who is, like you, accustomed to hope. Let it not be said, poets are without hope. I'm Joe Campana. I am. I can't guarantee the rest of these. I am really honored to be here. I want to thank everyone who makes Bread Loaf possible. That poem was called Live Oak. It is a Houston poem. As I confess to my workshop, I am always trying to be not where I am or where I'm from, but my poems make me honest. So I'm reading a couple Houston poems. This next one called Storm Song. I moved to Houston just after Katrina and Rita, just before Hurricane Ike pummeled the city. And I was thinking this week as I was reading Natasha Trethewey's After Katrina about that moment of moving there. This is called Storm Song. Last night, heat crept back over the city. We were like birds pinned to wires strung between stoplights, and we could not leave. No wind to speak of. In my notebook, I wrote the palms hardly waved, and that dream came to me again. You tell me it is no dream. Do you remember how, as we slept, storm clouds gathered over our heads? I remember reaching down to pluck you from the waters. In the dream, I could still do that. Bread Loaf is astonishing for many reasons, one of which, for me, is that I sat down at Alan Shapiro's extraordinary opening lecture next to my high school librarian, Tom Kerrigan, who is taking workshop with Michael. I owe a great, great debt to libraries. I grew up in one. My mother has worked in the Johnstown Public Library for over 35 years. And I owe a great debt to my mother, for whom, in a way, all my poems are written because, as she tells me, she doesn't understand poetry. So this is called Reference. Your skin is fire, the red leather you cling to. Old man folds the paper to his liking over and again. He crinkles. You shouldn't be here. This is what it means to read. Outside, a whole world you have no right to. You don't want it. A soft rain settles on the houses. In one of them, your father sleeps. He wakes when you go to bed, ties his shoes, drags a thermos of steam into the night. You dream of books. You never know what else to ask for. Afternoons, your mother opens and closes them, bringing down the stamp again and again. Red, she numbers them gently. She's giving them away. Who are you waiting for? The chair stares with dozens of golden eyes. It will not speak. I'm going to read a few poems from my last book, Natural Selections, which I wrote, started over 2 years teaching in a very small village in the middle of Ohio, Gambier, Ohio, teaching at Kenyon College, in a landscape. We'll talk after, Jamal, okay? It is a landscape that is lush and desolate, one in which you wonder if you are a predator or prey, one in which experiences of solitude and beauty and even what it is to be a citizen are thrown into relief by a kind of withering of that sort of particular corner of America. And I have that withering in mind. Many of my people I love, still live in it. The book is full of roads and animals, because when you experience solitude, you'll talk to anything, even if it's not, we're going to talk back. And roads, because they are a kind of memory. Putting a car on a road is like putting a needle on a record. This is one of those roads, Ohio 229. Afternoon hawk circles, another senseless road ripped around a bend. How potent the longing, how potent the fear, the two as one, the two as hawk and shadow comb a lifeless road. Doesn't empty mean safe? Another snap, another twig, another instinct ended. We were all hungry, circling each other's flesh as if it were nourishment. How did the hawk know what was left on the side of this road would spite appetite? Never end it. I got an image a number of years ago, emailed to me by my sister, of my eldest nephew, then 12 or 13 or whatever age you can be licensed to kill animals, of his sort of first kill, which seemed significant to me. And I wrote this poem, Hunting the Beast. You're old enough to lie, to grab the beast by its throat, cock the rifle, grip the barrel, jam the butt to your shoulder so it hurts, and loose the bullet from its cavern of scorn howling. To know the beast, to know the deer, to know an enemy scuffling in undergrowth. Shudder of capture. Now it's over. Rabbits lie down in their warrens, but you will drive them forth. Hawks twist in the clouds. They will hide the sun. You're old enough to know, to be the bowstring ripped taut, to stretch air into shape, to feel the arrow explode into form and catch in the haunch of a dark forest, its flesh your nightmare, to speak of anger, to speak of failure, report of weapons, retort of trees, taunt of wind. You want to trail the beast. You know the paths of twisting wood, but you cannot track yourself. The mind is full of sound, like the body. You're old enough to kill, to drag corpses in snow. This is how you learn to see the world. The bird hauled up with its dun plumage. It is your hand alone that makes the wings flutter, that squeezes dream from the lungs of the dead. If you can't fly away, no one will. Wolf. Little man, I said, keep the wolf from my door. One more night, one more wretched night and day. The wolf said, wait. And the season was packing its bags, but it would not leave, and it would never leave. Little man, I said, there's a tooth at my throat. And the tooth said time, and it was really a wolf, and it was cloaked in a sheepskin of satisfaction. And there was a fury raining down at night, and it tapped at the windows. Little man, I said, close the door. There's a wolf in the air, and there is a fury that even fear can't touch, and it is gnawing me. I feel it gnawing at me, and the wolf said shelter, and I knew it was a lie. I felt it as a lie. I could already feel its teeth tearing my skin. I'm finally in a region that understands that kind of despair you experience in the springtime when winter just keeps coming back. I live in Texas, I read this poem, don't really get it. So, spring comes to Ohio. The first gesture is despair, because the snowdrops have fled and the cold came back anyway. You are far from your love, and you will be nothing but the space between the hand and what it is accustomed to grasping. The first gesture is cold, but the rain still comes down, and like the rain, you lean your head down on someone's shoulder because it is too heavy for you to carry by yourself. Outside, the boys are like flowers, and the flowers like boys because they don't give what they say. All the evening flowers are coffins bursting with possibility. Why not pick one? Why not let your sorrow sink into the dirt where it will die? The first gesture is the hope that it will die before you will, or that you will learn to read it like a book. Come read. Come to the flower beds and the mowed down fields where the heads of yellow soldiers burst in the grass. If anyone ever gave you something, that gesture of fading beauty was the first sign that the price of generosity is the flower that would rather not be ripped from its heart. Come, read all the flowers. They were printed here just for you. Come, read your heart, which has shriveled into a flower receding before night. If the sun ever will come back, the first thing you'll do is reach right out to touch it. I'm going to read one new poem from the book I'm finishing up, a mixture of more poems of place from where I grew up, but also poems written out of a fascination with Life magazine, that sort of print run from the mid-30s to the early 70s. I was struck by the juxtapositions, and I was struck by events that had become, were already history by the time I was born, but that were alive in a very different way. This one, December 7, 1953, the issue published in the week of my mother's birth, which uncannily enough features Audrey Hepburn in a white men's dress shirt, nothing else, on a telephone staring out at the reader. A shirt loves a body the way a bracelet kisses a wrist, kisses the tender flesh stretched over tendon and vein, a whole world thrumming just below. Fingers love motion the way the flesh loves the deep electrical twitch of the body involuntary, satisfied with itself and one at last with a music that loves to fill a room the way a piano loves Liberace or Victor Borgia. Chrysler loves soldiers the way a mother loves a child, which strangely enough is not unlike the way Santa Claus loves toasters, deep fryers, coffee makers, and electric razors, all for the gift of their shiny utility. Oh, Pyrex, oh, Playtex, contain, contain, contain the ease of abundance, which loves to billow and fill a house the very way a chimney loves smoke, the way all conduits of transport love vicious motion. The silky burn of a Pall Mall searing like a car yearns for one great and final acceleration that can release only into starry conflagrations under a watchful desert sun. The desert loves sun almost as much as it loves secrets, just as a fugitive loves Texas and all solitary expanses of passage unimpeded by custom. Lovers love love, and even more, they love to play dead. Imagine the world whole and uninterrupted by a desire for witness, the world indifferent to all things pertaining, the lovers now like statues buried in the desert sand or hidden in a dark cave that aches for collapse. Chanel number 5 loves Chanel number 5 and wears nothing else to bed. Naked, at last, it is finally itself alone, vapors free in the night air and practically fire now, loving itself purely, the way everyone loves useless gifts, along with all other forms of generosity indifferent to duty. Imagine that. Someone loved you enough not to care, the way a train, uninterested in terminus, loves the interstitial hum of tracks. Certain of their own end, elephants love trains that speed from darkened tents. Pull back the flaps if you dare. All those circles filled with the round O's of faces tormented by wonder, stretched by their own credulity until the body becomes a letter that would tell you precisely how a body loves if only you could read it. Slack-jawed, wide-eyed, open-mouthed, the body one great aperture. That's how it loves, in the manner of the sky that loves the foolish conveyances of tiny creatures so ambitious for transport. And the sky loves them all, nearly as much as the shirt. Simple covering, loves the press of flesh beneath diffident folds, loves the way fabric caresses a body just as the eye strokes the camera, a shoulder cradles a phone, and the phone tenderly carries voices gathering a line from so far away. How could they sound so close? And it's just like a mother cradles the child she sees, she can no longer hold.